From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we remember hard-boiled fiction writer Mickey Spillane, who created the popular detective Mike Hammer. Spillane died earlier this week. And book critic Maureen Corrigan considers the complex appeal of Spillane's work. Also, country singer Ray Price talks about his 50 years in the business and his friend and mentor Hank Williams, who got Price onto the stage of the Grand Ole Opry. Next month, the Country Music Hall of Fame features an exhibit devoted to Price's life and music. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Lady in the Water, the new film by M. Night Shyamalan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. The hard-boiled writer Mickey Spillane, creator of tough guy detective Mike Hammer, died Monday at the age of 88. Spillane was one of the best-selling writers of his generation. He wrote his first Mike Hammer novel, I, the Jury, in 1947. Other Hammer stories include Vengeance is Mine, The Big Kill, and Kiss Me Deadly. Here's a scene from the movie version of Kiss Me Deadly made in 1955, starring Ralph Meeker as Hammer. A federal agent is chewing out Hammer for getting involved in their investigation.
Where's the key?
What key?
The key you took from Doc Kennedy. I want it.
I don't know what you're talking about.
The key is very important. Don't waste my time. Hand it over.
Is it as important as Velda?
If you hadn't sent Velda out to do your dirty work, she wouldn't be in trouble. Now give me the key.
Will you make a deal for her?
Please, the key.
Sure, you'll make a deal for her. Like you did for Christina. You held her under custody in a hospital and you let her get away. You let her get killed. The way Raimondo and Kowalski were killed. And Nick. And maybe Carver, too, for all I know.
Carver?
Yeah, surprised? What kind of an investigation you're running around here anyway?
Mike Hammer came to life in more films and TV series. Spillane himself played the part of Hammer in the 1963 movie The Girl Hunters. In the 1930s, he was known for his pulp magazine pieces. He also wrote for comic books early in his career and was one of the originators of the superheroes Captain Marvel and Captain America. Today we listen back to Terry's 1989 interview with Mickey Spillane. Then book critic Maureen Corrigan will consider his place in the genre of detective writing. Terry's interview with Spillane started with him reading from the first Mike Hammer novel, I, the Jury.
When I looked up, Pat was staring at me strangely. He shook his head. I knew what he was thinking. Mike, lay off. For God's sake, don't go half-cocked about this. I know you too well. You'll start shooting up anyone connected with this and getting a jam you'll never get out of. I'm over it now, Pat. Don't get excited. From now on, I'm after one thing, the killer. You're a cop, Pat. You're tied down by rules and regulations. There's someone over you. I'm alone. I can slap someone in the puss and they can't do a damn thing. No one can kick me out of my job. Maybe there's no way to put up a huge fuss if I get gunned down. But then I still have a private cop's license with the privilege of pack a rod and they're afraid of me. I hate hard, Pat. When I latch onto the one behind this, they're going to wish they hadn't started it. Someday, before long, I'm going to have my rod and my mitt and the killer in front of me. I'm going to watch the killer's face. I'm going to plunk one right in his gut when he's dying on the floor and may kick his teeth out. You couldn't do that. You have to follow a book because you're a captain of homicide. Maybe the killer will wind up in a chair. You'd be satisfied, but I wouldn't. It's too easy. That killer is going down like Jack did.
Well, I think this sets up the character pretty well. And that whole sense of, and when he's dying on the floor, I may kick his teeth out.
Yeah. How about that?
So, I mean, what does that say about the character? I mean, what did you want to get in there?
Well, the character, something terrible has been done to Mike. His best friend has been shot. Not only shot, but has been shot in a horrible way because that the killer wanted to see that guy hurt. Because shot him where it wasn't a death-dealing blow with that shot. He shot him in the gut. He's going to live a while. He's going to be in terrible pain. And that's the way that killer's going to die. So this is the premise of the whole story, that killer's going down just like Jack did, his friend did. And that's what happens.
And Mike Hammer says that in the end, the people have their justice. They get it through guys like me once in a while. You've made Hammer into the guy who's going to get justice outside of the law.
That's right. In this case, he's acting as an arm of the law, but in a different way. He can do things that nobody else can do. He's got more reason for doing it. He's not hung up by rules and regulations the way the cop was. And it's a case of personal vendetta on his part. See, I never had Mike Hammer ever taking a case for money. Everything he ever got into was because of a personal motivation. Something happened to somebody he liked, somebody he loved, some situations were terrible, and he got into it, and with no money behind it. He was on his own all the way because this was a personal nature with him. And he needed all of his attention.
Hammer seems to take a lot of, almost pleasure in vengeance and in returning pain that's been received. Is it cathartic for you to write that way?
No, I never used that particular idea. When you're going into a tough situation, pain's going to be there. You don't want to dwell on these things. But there are certain episodes that require this type of thing. If you want to see pain, violence, sex, you read your newspapers. There's plenty of it there. We have to bring it in where it belongs in the book in order to make the book interesting. You just can't write all about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a certain rhythm. I mean, in some ways, I think you're really at your best when you're writing violent scenes. There's a certain rhythm that you get in those
scenes.
Yeah,
you can get mad when you write. I punch holes in my paper. Either you always make holes or periods go right into the platen of the machine. I break up typewriters so fast that when I'm done with a story, that machine has to go in for repair. So you know what I'd do to if I ever worked with a word processor, tear it apart.
At the end of I, the Jury.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is this like perhaps your most famous scene?
Well, this is the one that's so well remembered. This is the one I told you about. They said it was a sensual scene. I see Mike, he's got a premise in his life. He is going to kill the person who killed his friend in the same way by shooting him in the gut. Now, at the end of the story there, when he's faced down with this woman that he loves, Charlotte, she knows what he wants to do. She has to get him away from this attitude. She starts to unrobe. She takes her clothes off piece by piece. And the description is of her getting down to the point where she's nude. And then she leans over while she's about to kiss him. She's really reaching for a gun behind his head. Now, if he's true to his premise, he'll stay alive. If he's not true to it, she's going to kill him. And, of course, what he does, he stays true. He shoots her right in the gut. Now, she's a psychiatrist. She couldn't understand that. And she says, "How could you?" And he says, "It was easy." And that's the way he was. That was the end of the story.
And that's your most famous line, I think, that it was easy.
Oh, yeah, it was easy.
Was it considered very unusual to have the private eye kill a woman at the end of a book?
Well, they didn't used to do it in those days. Women were sort of held up on a pedestal. I knocked this one off. I've only killed, I think, two women. Made them villains in any of my stories, but they were effective.
Now, why is that something you wanted to topple in your story?
Women can be as deadly as men any time. Again, you know, just refer back to your newspapers. But it was fun doing it to them. Of course, there are other times when women are treated with much more consideration than that.
Were there any limits, editorial limits, censorship limits, to how much sex and violence you could use in the book and still be mass marketed? Were you always cognizant of what your limits were?
Well, the editors do funny things. When I wrote One Lonely Night, Mike Hammer killed off 200 people with a machine gun, kept reloading and shooting. He was in a commie nest, a real deadly area, and he shot 200 people. And the editor says, "Oh, that's much too much blood." So they knocked it down to 100 people.
That was supposed to be a big change.
That's your editorial concept.
In your novels, women lick their luscious lips seductively a lot.
Yeah.
I know I'm a woman and not a man, but I've really never seen a woman lick her lips.
You never were watching.
Perhaps. As I say, you know...
That's a little game they play, you know.
Have you seen that a lot? Because, you know, I remember...
Sure, I've seen it many times. The French said they make a moo, M-O-U-E, you know,
I read that you were actually with the police on the bust of a narcotics ring.
Oh, I was on several of those big ones, yeah.
But that you took two bullets on one of them.
Well, I got one. Uh-huh. That was enough. Well, it was one shot, but it was a buckshot in the darn thing. Whenever you go out playing around, you're going to get hurt. So the best thing to do, don't go where trouble happens. Otherwise, you're going to be part of it, and then you can get clobbered. I'm not about looking for any of these things anymore. I'll use everything that's in my mind. I will use my imagination. I'll get into fiction and keep it that way. I don't want any more realism. That gets to be rough.
Well, this is a kind of weird question, but when you actually were shot, I don't know if this is too weird or not, but how did it compare with how you imagined it was when you had characters being shot in your books?
Well, it was a little bit screwy because I was standing behind a whole bunch of tomato paste. There was a slogan for this tomato paste: who put those six big tomatoes in the itty-bitty cans? And the bullet went through the cans, got everybody splashed with tomato paste, and everybody thought they had all been shot as well.
Oh, jeez.
So the shot just sprayed around, and it was...
How bizarre. Since you had tomato sauce all over, were you able to figure out right away where the actual wound was?
Yeah, you'll know right where that is,
right,
but
okay.
You're not considering that right away. All you know is everybody got clobbered, and that was, you know, it was kind of hard to get the tomato sauce off, though. It wasn't deadly, I'll tell you that.
So, is the sensation something that you've recalled for writing?
No. You're better off if you use your imagination. You know, writing is something completely different. When you're writing fiction, it's easy. You can do things with fiction that nobody would ever believe in. Words are great. They're expressive. You can say things that you'd never experience and make them sound real. Hey, that's what being a writer is all about. I have as much fun writing as I do have reading.
Terry Gross speaking with detective writer Mickey Spillane in 1989. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Mickey Spillane. He created the popular detective Mike Hammer.
You've said that the first part of a story that comes to you is the ending, because that's where you have
sure.
to get to, and that's in your novels the most, the kind of, you know, the dramatic climax. Seems to me your titles come from the last page, too.
Not always, no. When you're writing, see, it's like a joke. The only part of a joke you listen to is that punchline. So when you develop a story, that's your important part, is the big ending on there. Now, O. Henry did this in all of his stuff, and he was an old-time writer. I've just gone ahead and elaborated on his style a little bit in the structure of a story. Titles come out of the air. I don't know where they come from, but when I was doing The Killing Man, we couldn't get a title for that, and we were writing down all sorts of titles. We put them on the computers looking for any duplications and whatnot. And I was sitting there, all of a sudden I looked at it, I said, The Killing Man, that's it. And just popped into my head.
Mm-hmm.
But I really don't try for a title until after the book is finished.
Something I recently learned about you is that you are, or were, I'm not sure which, a Jehovah's Witness.
Oh, I've been a Jehovah's Witness since 1951.
You know, what surprised me about that was that I know you're not your character, but, I mean, Hammer is such the man alone that it seemed like hard for me to fathom that you were, you know, part of an organized religion.
Well, I'm not going to discuss it with you now, but next time one of Jehovah's Witnesses is knocking on the door, call them in. They'll tell you all about it. But religion's a strange thing, you know. It's something you have personally in your lives, and you got to believe in it, and I believe in what I believe in.
Can I ask if
sure.
if the witnesses have ever objected to your books?
No. I don't think they read them, and I don't blame them. But... Now, when you're writing, it's just this is a job with me. I don't write for any express purpose like passing messages around. It's strictly a job. I try to keep them fairly contemporary and fairly clean. The first time I used a four-letter word in a book, I thought the publisher was going to go out of their minds, and this was a long time after it was coming out in other books. I don't try to use bad language, mainly because these are, again, are exclamation points within the story. And I try to keep things as... normal as possible. Anybody wants to read violence and sex, go to the newspaper. There's plenty of it there.
Something else I recently learned about you is that you collect blue willow pottery.
Yeah.
Which is a surprising hobby for a hard-boiled guy.
Well, it's not a one-time blue willow was just cheap kitchenware for all the farm ladies all over the country. It was made by different companies, but there was a classic thing about it. It was all excellently made. It was great chinaware, cheap, very cheap. But now it's up on the stage where, you know, it becomes antique and looks nice. And I lost a whole mess of it down
in the
hurricane.
Yeah.
And my wife collects pewterware, and she lost her pewterware. But we'll get it back. There's a lot of it out there, and the fun is going out collecting these things and doing it again. And I like it. It's useful. It's pretty looking. And it reminds me of my childhood, because we had it at home.
Well, speaking of your childhood... Your father was a bartender?
Yeah, he was a good Irish bartender in Brooklyn.
So did you hang out at that bar?
No, I never hang out. I would never hang out at a bar because I don't like the atmosphere of a bar. Nobody goes into a bar to get sober. And again, it's a trouble spot. Bar scenes where you have restaurants, this is a different situation. But when you speak of a bar, you know what you're speaking of is like a neighborhood pub type of bar where everybody's in there and it's a place where they go and they don't want to go home. But I don't hang around in those places.
Mm-hmm.
I never did.
Mickey Spillane, thanks a lot for talking with us.
I'm glad to be here.
Terry Gross speaking with detective writer Mickey Spillane in 1989. He died Monday at the age of 88. How can a nice girl fall for a trench-coated tough guy who treats women like dirt and ridicules book-reading sissies? Book critic Maureen Corrigan tries to fathom the appeal of Mickey Spillane's Mike Hammer.
If you want the inside dope on Mickey Spillane, specifically why he's such a problematic writer for somebody like me, a dame who loves detective fiction and defends its literary value, you need look no further than his first Mike Hammer novel, I, the Jury, published in 1947. In fact, look no further than the infamous original cover of the paperback edition of that novel. The artwork depicts a man pointing a gun at a Zoftig woman who's in the process of stripping. Her breasts are jutting out of an unbuttoned blouse, and they so distract the eye that it takes a moment to register exactly where that gun is pointing, at the woman's uterus. I, the Jury, is credited with a lot of firsts, introducing in the thuggish character of Mike Hammer the first real anti-hero detective, ushering a new level of graphic violence and sexuality into hard-boiled mystery fiction, and inaugurating the paperback revolution in publishing. But another first that I, the Jury, pioneered isn't usually mentioned. Critics say it's the first mystery novel in which the femme fatale is, so to speak, fatally impregnated by the detective with a bullet. As a social critic, Spillane was about as nuanced as a can of Raid. Even in a genre not traditionally known for its enlightened views towards women, Spillane's novels were standouts in their fear and loathing of female sexuality. And temptresses weren't the only targets of Mike Hammer's social cleansing program. He mowed down sissies, commies, foreigners, psychoanalysts, rich people, bookworms, and basically anybody who wasn't a manly man like Mike himself. The only reason his longtime secretary and occasional sidekick, Velda, lasted as long as she did was because, as we're told from the outset, she just missed in the sex appeal department. Lucky for her. As a literary stylist, Spillane wasn't anything to sing about either. He grabbed hold of the detective fiction formula, drained out the hard-boiled poetry of Hammett and Chandler, and left only a brute bluntness behind. Here's Mike explaining the crude code of justice he lives by. After the war, I've been almost anxious to get to some of the rats that make up the section of humanity that prey on people. People. How incredibly stupid they could be sometimes. A trial by law for a killer. A loophole in the phrasing that lets a killer crawl out. But in the end, the people have their justice. They get it through me once in a while. They crack down on society, and I crack down on them. I shoot them like the mad dogs they are. Writing like that earned Spillane shudders from the critics. Malcolm Cowley in The New Republic threw the book at Spillane in 1952, calling him a homicidal paranoiac, as well as a sadist and a masochist. Spillane shot back at his detractors, saying, "I don't give a hoot about reading reviews. What I want to read is the royalty checks." And what jolly reading they must have been. The novels that repulsed critics delighted a hell of a lot of readers, including his most famous fan, Ayn Rand. Spillane is among the top best-selling and most widely translated authors of all time, by some tallies only outsold by the novels of Agatha Christie and the Bible. There's certainly a darkly nostalgic attraction about the Hammer novels. Since the late 1960s, the politics of American detective fiction have been happily reversed. Crusading detectives like Robert B. Parker Spencer and Sarah Paretsky's V.I. Warshawski championed the forces of feminism and cultural diversity. Amidst this crowd of socially progressive gumshoes, Mike Hammer seems like a trench-coated dinosaur. And yet, as students in my detective fiction courses complain, the newer, enlightened detectives talk too much. Many of my students prefer Mike because he's the spare embodiment of the hard-boiled formula, a loner detective who just acts without cluttering up his investigation with fancy metaphors. I, too, get an undeniable kick from reading about the Big Palooka's adventures, the way he takes matters into his own calloused hands. Thinking about Hammer and the passing of Mickey Spillane this week made me realize what was crucially absent from The Devil Wears Prada, a movie I found exasperating. the movie needed a climactic walk-on by Mike Hammer. Working girl Anne Hathaway kowtowed and even came to admire her awful boss, Meryl Streep. Whatever Mike would have done to Streep's snooty character would have been immoral and illegal, but at least, unlike the supine Hathaway, he wouldn't have licked her designer heels. Mike may have been a barbarian, and his deadly misogynist streak definitely required therapeutic intervention, but his class politics were always as golden as a freshly drawn mug of beer.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Kiss me, Mike. I want you to kiss me. Kiss me. The liar's kiss that says I love you, but means something else. You're good at giving such kisses. Kiss me.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, in stores and online at bn.com. From Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created by Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding. And from Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, country music singer Ray Price. Next month, the Country Music Hall of Fame opens an exhibit devoted to Price's life and music. Also, a review of the new M. Night Shyamalan film, Lady in the Lake.
I was the one that you fooled yesterday. Whose heart are you breaking now? You took our romance and threw it away. Whose heart are you breaking now? What has become of the love I once knew? What have you done with each vow? Somebody else now is king for a day. Whose heart are you breaking now?
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. When Ray Price was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame in 1996, he was described by Chris Christopherson as a living link from Hank Williams to the country music of today. Price was Hank Williams' protege and roommate in the early 50s after Price moved to Nashville. Soon after, Price helped give several country performers their starts. Early in their careers, Willie Nelson, Roger Miller, Johnny Paycheck, and Johnny Bush played in Price's band, the Cherokee Cowboys. Price was born in Cherokee County, Texas in 1926. His country hits have included Crazy Arms, Release Me, Heartaches by the Number, and For the Good Times. Price is still performing, and next month the Country Music Hall of Fame in Nashville will honor the 80-year-old honky-tonk singer with an exhibit devoted to his life and music. The exhibit will run until next June. Terry spoke with Ray Price in 1999. Before we hear their conversation, here's Ray Price's version of Ramblin' Rose.
Ramblin' Rose, Ramblin' Rose, why you ramble, no one knows. Wild and windblown, that's how you've grown. Who can cling to a ramblin' rose? Ramble on, ramble on. When you're rambling, days are gone. Who will love you with a love true? When you're rambling, days are gone. Ramblin' Rose, Ramblin' Rose.
Let's talk a little bit about your past. I know you grew up in Texas. Where did you grow up, and what was that community like?
Well, I came from Northeast Texas, which was then Wood County and Upshur County. It's a rural area, and my family were all farmers on both sides. And then my mother and dad moved to Dallas, and of course I went to Dallas with them. And I was raised in Dallas and went to college in Arlington, Texas. So it's a pretty part of the state.
One of the people who helped you a lot early in your career was Hank Williams, the
right.
great country singer. How did you meet him?
Well, the music publisher in Nashville who got me a contract with Columbia Records got me on one of Hank's radio shows. Every Friday night in Nashville, they would, if the stars were in town, they would be on their own radio shows at WSM in Nashville. And I was a guest. The music publisher, Troy Martin, had gotten me in a spot on his show, and I met him. And we became real close friends, and he got me on the Grand Ole Opry. And he and his wife were getting divorced, and
Hank Williams got you on the Grand Ole Opry.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And then we lived together. We had a house there in Nashville, and I would stay. I had the upstairs. He had the lower for about a year, and then, of course, he passed away.
And you're saying that you started living together after he and his wife separated?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he had to have somebody. He had a problem with alcohol, and we were real close, and I'd take care of him. Everything was fine.
What would you do for him?
Oh, just whatever needed to be done, like go to the store and things like that.
Would you try to keep him from alcohol or keep him comfortable with it? Or?
Well, yeah, but you just don't do it. Oh, no, I wouldn't give him anything. No way. But, yeah, like any of your friends, if they got into it too far, you'd try to help them if they were ill.
Now, I read someplace, and you could tell me if this is true, because there's so many legends surrounding famous people, but I read that Hank Williams tried to shoot you a couple of times, that he shot at you a couple of times.
No, honey, that is a real big prevarication.
Okay.
Real big. No way.
Okay.
It had to come from somebody that may have been a little envious back there somewhere.
Right.
It really didn't happen. The reason why that Hank and I stopped living together right at the last was the fact that he was in the hospital so many times and having so much trouble. And one of the times I was ordered by the man, Jim Denny, who ran the Artist Service Bureau in Nashville and handled Hank, to take him to the hospital. And Hank got a little ill at me for that, and so I moved. But we never lost the friendship we had.
Did he help you get on the Grand Ole Opry the first time?
Sure did.
What did he do to get you on there? Were you performing in his act or opening for him? Or?
No, it was one Saturday night, Red Foley, who was one of the big stars in the star of the Prince Albert, which was the network show. Wife had died, and Hank had took the host position on the show, and he wanted me for his guest. And you didn't get on the Grand Ole Opry back then without a hit record, and I was years away from a hit record. So, but he got me on, and they sent me to take care of him on a trip one time, and everything worked out all right, so they signed me to a contract.
What do you mean they sent you to take care of him on a trip? They knew that he was having problems and he needed kind of like a guardian?
Yeah, and he needed somebody to get up and sing in case he didn't make it, and that was hard to do. That happened to me in Norfolk on New Year's Day, and I didn't know what to do because they come running in and said, well, you're going to have to take Hank's place. And here I was. Nobody even knew who I was. And I said, well, there's no way I can do that. But anyway, they put me out there with Hank's band, and we made it all right. And the people kind of liked me because I had made a mistake by naming one of the songs in a higher key than I ought to have been. And I let them know about it. So it turned kind of amusing for a while. And from then on, Norfolk was one of the best towns for me.
How would you explain it to the audience that Hank Williams couldn't make it?
Well, you let the promoter do that. And there were other stars on the show, Johnny and Jack, Kitty Wells, and we were all trying to cover up the fact because it was 10 or 12,000 people there. And the promoter went out and I forget what he said, that Hank was ill or something. But some of the times, Hank wouldn't even be drinking, and the promoters would get him to drinking so they didn't have to pay him.
You're kidding?
No, I'm not kidding, honey.
So this way they'd get all the ticket sales, but they wouldn't have to pay him?
Well, they wouldn't have to pay him because he breached his contract. He come in there and got drunk, didn't do a good show. And they'd put him on the stage while he's inebriated, and nobody can get on the stage and sing drunk.
Uh-huh. But in the meanwhile, the promoter would have had maybe a full house and made all the money on the ticket sales.
Well, take $50,000 or $60,000, put it in his pocket, and go home.
Huh. Let's pause here for some music and hear one of your early hits. In fact, this was your first number one recording. This is called Crazy Arms. It was recorded in 1956. Do you want to say anything about the recording before we hear it?
Well, yeah. It was in 1956, and Bob Martin, a disc jockey in Tampa, Florida, had found a record of Crazy Arms. And it wasn't a very good record. But he was intrigued by the song, and he played it for me, and I was too. And then when I recorded it, it became a monster. It was my first million seller, and it crossed over. And at that time, they didn't know what a crossover was. But it was the first big one I had, you're right.
Let's hear it. This is my guest, Ray Price, recorded in 1956. Impact of having a number one hit?
Well, I got to eat pretty regular.
Were you having trouble doing that before?
Oh, yeah. All young ones have trouble. In fact, Lefty Frizzell and I started out together, and we used to split a bowl of stew in Dallas when we were first starting. But everything got better, and like it always does. And I don't know, that's about all I can say. It gave me an opportunity to do things that I hadn't been able to do up to that point.
Country singer Ray Price speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1999 interview with country music legend Ray Price.
Now, I believe after Hank Williams died, you used his band for a while.
I used his band for about 2 years, and there's two or three of them that's passed on now, but the rest of them, we're all dear friends. But I got to sounding too much like Hank on records, and it was because the music was so locked in, it had to sound like Hank. And we had to break up, and broke up in Grand Junction, Colorado, if I remember correctly.
Did you feel that your singing style changed when you got your own band?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
How did it change?
Well, I went back to singing Texas style, and not the way Hank and the band played. He had no drums or anything like that. And, of course, I brought a Texas swing band to Nashville to go to work with me. And from then on, that's the way it was. That's where I earned the title as the number one honky-tonk player. Because that's the only place you could play at that time was in the nightclubs.
Well, you mentioned Western Swing. You did an album, I think it was in the late 1950s, of songs that were first recorded by Bob Wills, the kind of father of Western Swing. Did you ever know him?
Oh, yeah, I knew Bob real well. When I was first starting in Dallas, he had a nightclub called Bob Wills Ranch House. It later became another nightclub after he left it. But when he was on the road with his band, he would always let me and a band play in his place. He did me a big favor. And, of course, that was my tribute to him, was that album.
Well, this album features the band that you put together after you used the Hank Williams band, or one of the versions of the band you put together, and Willie Nelson is in this band. You had several really great people in your band. Johnny Bush was in your band for a while, the great singer.
Roger Miller was the front man.
Yeah. How did you find these people who became so famous in their own right? How did you end up having them as sidemen in your band?
Well, they were all looking for a job, Terry. Everything was tough back there. And I hired Roger. He was working in the fire department in Amarillo, Texas. And I needed a fiddle player, and he came out to play fiddle. And his fiddle playing was terrible. And when he got through, he said, "How'd you like that?" And I said, "Well, can you sing and play guitar?" And it kind of shook him, and he said, "Yeah." So I hired him as a front man.
Huh.
And he did real well. Roger and I were real close, just like Willie and I are still close.
Well, it sounded like you were determined to hire him whether he was good or not.
Well, I had heard him sing.
Oh, okay, yeah. And had you heard Willie Nelson sing before you hired him?
Well, Willie worked for my publishing company, Pamper Music.
Oh, so you knew his songs.
Oh, yeah, all of them. And, of course, Willie was having a hard time, too. And Johnny Paycheck had gone out on his own, and Willie replaced Johnny Paycheck on bass, and then he would play guitar sometimes.
So let's hear something from this Bob Wills tribute album, the one where Willie Nelson's featured in the band. And I just looked at the recording date on this. It was recorded in 1961, and I thought we'd hear Time Changes Everything. You want to say anything about it?
Just a great song.
It is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Here we go.
Country-wise.
This is Ray Price.
There was a time when I thought of no other, and we sang our own love's refrain. Our hearts beat as one as we had our fun, but time changes everything. When you left me, my poor heart was broken. Our romance seemed all in vain. The dark clouds are gone and there's blue skies again. Our time changes everything.
That's Ray Price from his 1961 album San Antonio Rose. It's a tribute to Bob Wills, and it's been reissued in the past couple of years. Was that Willie Nelson singing harmony, by the way?
Could have been. Now, Willie and I recorded a San Antonio Rose album in around 1979, I think.
And that was a big hit on the country charts.
It was a big one, real big.
Yeah. I know that there's a lot of country music performers who are, you know, acknowledged as being, you know, among the greats, who don't get played much on country music radio anymore, including Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson. Do you feel that you're in that predicament as well?
Well, yeah, I'm in the same box. That all is brought down from the higher-ups in the industry, which I guess would be New York or L.A., and they felt like they could make a whole lot money, more money with the young kids playing rock music, but they had to name it something besides rock or it wouldn't sell. And so they named it country music, but it's really rock music. It's the old Beatles sound.
So I take it it's a sound you don't much like or don't feel that you perform
anyways.
Beatles.
I like the Beatles. I think they ought to play the Beatles. They don't need to play the rest of them. The Beatles have already done it. Now, that sounds hateful, and I'm sorry for that.
In the mid-60s or so, you started using more heavily arranged settings, you know, strings and orchestras, moving away from a more honky-tonk kind of sound. What led you in that direction?
The honky-tonks.
What do you mean?
Yeah, it wasn't fun playing honky-tonks, and I was trying to broaden my audience out. Also, I thought that if country music was going to really win approval all over the country, they had to do something to kind of fix it where the people that listened to the Tony Bennett's and the Frank Sinatra's and those people would like the song or the music. And country music songs are great. I think they're beautiful songs, and to put the strings with them, that's my idea of how to make one really great song.
And did that work for you? Did it get you where you wanted to be in venues that other pop singers were singing?
Well, it got me on a lot of places, yeah. Sure did. I became one of Johnny Carson's favorite singers, which I'm very proud of. And I did a lot of things with him in New York before he moved to California and afterwards. But, it got me where I wanted to be, and I got out of the honky-tonks, and I still play dances every now and then for some of my old fans, but I'm not really into that anymore.
Ray Price speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. Next month, the Country Music Hall of Fame in Nashville opens an exhibit devoted to his life and music.
Tonight in a bar room I'm sitting, apart from the laughter and the cheer. The scenes of my life pass before me while watching the bubbles in my beer. A vision of someone who loved me brings a lone silent tear to my eye. A failure, just watching the bubbles in my beer.
Coming up, a review of the new M. Night Shyamalan film, Lady in the Water. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
After his blockbuster The Sixth Sense, writer and director M. Night Shyamalan has earned mixed reviews from critics, but made big money at the box office with Unbreakable, Signs, and The Village. He says his new fantasy, Lady in the Water, is his most heartfelt work. He even left his longtime studio, Disney, when executives there didn't share his enthusiasm for the project. David Edelstein has this review.
It's been a tough week for film critics. Clerks 2 director Kevin Smith publicly lambasted ABC's Joel Siegel, who swore loudly and walked out of a screening during a scene in which characters discussed having sex with a donkey. Now, I know I'm being disloyal to a brother critic, but Joel, dude, Kevin's right. That was way uncool. On the other hand, M. Night Shyamalan's hostility to critics seems unwarranted. In The Lady in the Water, he gives us a pasty little prisspot of a critic who gets torn to shreds by a rogue scrunt. Even if you don't know what a scrunt is, you gotta know it's nasty. See, in Shyamalan's universe, the critic represents the doubter, the underminer of childlike spirituality and fantasy. I don't want to get too Freudian, but in interviews, Shyamalan says his parents did that too. So what is this, some kind of Oedipal revolt? We know from Michael Bamberger's new book, The Man Who Heard Voices, that Shyamalan won't work with people who don't love him unconditionally. Their doubt brings him down, the way the jaded, arrogant critic played by Bob Balaban nearly brings down the narf played by Bryce Dallas Howard. Let me backtrack. The Lady in the Water is like Splash reworked by a grandiose Sunday school teacher. It centers on a traumatized apartment complex superintendent called Cleveland Heap, played by Paul Giamatti, who finds himself the caretaker of a sort of sea nymph, a narf, from an ancient water realm called the Blue World. In a prologue, we learn that narfs and man were once linked, but man became greedy and the species parted ways. But narfs occasionally still reach out to humans. This one, she's called Story, has come to impart a message to a writer, played by the Shyamster himself. He must keep writing, she says, because the book he's struggling to finish will inspire a child who will one day transform the world. Cleveland learns about narfs and scrunts, they're the hellhounds who try to eat narfs, from a Korean grandmother tenant, and he realizes he needs a whole entourage to protect Story. But who, he wonders, could fill the prescribed roles? Ah, the critic knows about storytelling. Let's ask the critic.
What is it you want anyway?
Well, I had a question. You're an expert on plots, right? You know who's going to do what in a book or a movie, even at the beginning, yes?
There is no originality left in the world, Mr. Heap. That is a sad fact I've come to live with.
Well, if there was a mystery, and a guy had to figure out who some people were, like he had to find a symbol guy, someone who can figure out messages, and a guild of people who are going to be important at the end as a group, how would you figure that out?
The symbol person should be simple. Look for any character who was doing something mundane but required analysis. Someone who was skilled at puzzles. As for the guild, look for any group of characters that are always seen together and have seemingly irrelevant and tedious dialogue that seems to regurgitate forever. Is there anything further I can assist you with during my nap time?
No, Mr. Farber. Thank you.
The critic, of course, gets it all wrong. And that's why he's reviled and ripped to shreds. He should have known not to be such a know-it-all creep. Okay, let's be fair. Critics dish it out. Critics should be able to take it. The problem is that The Lady in the Water is so adolescent in the way it conflates spiritual doubt with doubt of Shyamalan. There's no place in his universe even for dramatic tension, which is why the movie is boring you silly when it's not making you snicker. Every member of the apartment complex surrogate family jumps right on board the Narf Express, instantly committed to beating back scrunts with the power of their faith, while the audience stares dumbly at the screen. Movies like Spielberg's E.T. are adolescent fantasies, too. But Shyamalan can't stir your emotions the way Spielberg does. Shyamalan is good at alienation and flat-out horror. But there isn't much warmth or romance on his palette. When Bryce Dallas Howard huddles semi-clothed in a shower, there's little going on in her lovely, chiseled face. She's a beatific lump. I know in trashing Shyamalan's fairy tale, I'm aligning myself with the critic in the film. But the critic in the film makes a big mistake. He tries to make sense of the hero's ravings. This critic would just have said, "Sorry, pal, your story stinks."
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of 10 Second Staircase, a Bryant and May British mystery by Christopher Fowler, author of The Water Room. From the David Bruce Smith Family Foundation, supporting humanitarian causes. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that more students graduate from high school ready for college, work, and citizenship. GatesFoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with reporters Tom Hamburger and Peter Walston, authors of the new book, One Party Country, The Republican Plan for Dominance in the 21st Century. Join us for the next Fresh Air.